Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
To the program. Tonight's very special guest is Joseph Ross. Joseph, are you with me?
I'm here. Thank you. I'm grateful to be with you.
Well, good. I'm glad. I'm glad as well. What is poetry, Joseph?
Boy, you start with the big questions, and I like that. You know, poetry is probably one of those things that we humans have been doing since the very beginning. Maybe we scribbled the first ones on cave walls, or we chanted them around the fire. But it is language that comes out of us, out of the heart, out of the gut. Obviously, you know, today we would say it involves rhythm and rhyme and various devices and all of these things. But I would say most importantly that poetry is that expression through our language that helps us to give voice to the things that we love, that we fear, gives voice to a human emotion. And that's a very important thing to do.
Yes, very nice definition. Why do you think that it's important?
Because we've all got emotions, and emotions are often the things that bind us to one another. They're the things that scare us, they're the things that move us to love, to bravery, and we have to express them. We know what happens to human beings when we keep lots of intense feelings inside of ourselves. That's almost never a good thing. And others can benefit from it. Think of the things you've learned, I've learned from the poems of others. Things they've taught me about myself. Things they've taught me about what it means to be human. I think we need to share poetry, write it and share it for all those reasons, yeah.
Right. What sparked your initial love of poetry?
I think that, taking it seriously when I was in college, which is a long time ago, but reading various, mostly American poets, some poets from Western Europe, some of the Irish poets really got my attention. William Yeats, Americans like Emily Dickinson and Langston Hughes. I studied them and thought, and in classes, it was in school. I wasn't out discovering it on my own quite yet. But I saw them doing something in language that I had just never seen before. You know, the same reasons, like, you know, nobody says, I'm getting married. Would you read an essay at my wedding? You know, nobody says that. They say, would you read a poem? Because you discover that this poem is doing something in language that is rare, that other forms can't quite do. So that captured me. And I suppose, like most kind of young people, I had a lot of things kind of swirling around inside, and the writing came. Lots of bad poems, especially at the beginning. but yeah, I think it came it came to me in school, I guess I would say. Yeah.
Okay. You know, as you think about your work, what are some of the predominant themes of your work?
Yeah. I write a lot about race. I write a lot about, these days I think about immigration. I write a lot about, I try to write about the things that move me, and I'm mostly moved by, the ways we love each other, the ways we cause each other to suffer. A few years ago, I was talking with a couple of people about transgender people and realized I knew exactly nothing about that reality. And so I tried to throw myself into that and to listen to people and read. And I have begun to write a little bit about that. But I think when a lot of times when people think of me and my work, they think that it's a bit political, which I suppose that's true. And I do like to write a lot about history and about race, because those are the things that matter to me at this time. Those are, I feel like, the things that are facing us all.
All right. Well, please share one of your works.
Sure. I'd like to start with a poem from Ake that is about, it's called For Gilberto Ramos. He was a 15-year-old Guatemalan boy who died in the Texas desert. Several years ago, I read this story about him in the LA Times, and this poem came for Gilberto Ramos. Before you left, your mother draped you with 50 Hail Marys, a rosary of white wood, a constellation she hoped might guide you. But Texas does not know these prayers. It knows that desert air is thirsty and you are made of water. It drank you slowly, your name only linked to your body by the string of aves still around your neck, the small cross pressing against your wooden skin, the color of another cross. You left home on May 17th with one change of clothes and two countries ahead of you, your brother's phone number hidden on the back of your belt buckle so the coyote couldn't find it. The coyotes prey in the language of extortion. The phone number was found by a Texas official whose name your brother couldn't remember. She called and spoke in the language of bones. He translated her news into "pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death." His prayer meant brother, a word he kept moist just beneath his tongue. Or for Gilberto Ramos.
That was very powerful.
Thank you
for sharing.
Please share another.
Please share another.
Well, let me stay on the immigration theme for a minute then.
All right.
I was raised a Catholic, and I thought I had knew everything about the Catholic saints, but I had never heard of this saint named Saint Toribio Romo Gonzalez. He was a Mexican priest in the very first 28 years of the 20th century, 1900 and 1928. And today he is kind of a patron for those who cross the southern border.
Oh, wow.
They pin photographs of him or holy cards of him inside their coats as a kind of a way to keep them safe. So here's a little series. Can I read like three of these maybe?
Oh, yes, please, please.
Okay, they're relatively short, but they're all related. So Santo Toribio, sweatshirt. Your wrinkled image secured inside his sweatshirt, safety pinned on four sides so he feels you press his own sweating skin. You, a serious saint, lips that say prayers, eyes that mean martyrdom. Your stories are legend among the near dead, that they dreamed of you and woke to water, that they prayed to you and found apples in the desert, that they gazed at your image and heard your warning to go back, later to learn there was more desert than they could breathe. Your hands anointed for wandering souls, your hands tilting the chalice to the lips of a starving faith. Santo Toribio Chapel. The desert wind whispers through ocotillo branches, shredded fingers pleading to a silent sky. They say, when we are close to death, we will see you, hear you. Words of comfort, maybe a jar of water, maybe your hand will point to the true north. We stopped at your chapel in Jalisco, but felt no comfort there. We had too many miles ahead of us, too many countries. We saw your image in the stained glass window, holding a canteen and a cup. But we need the miracle, not the mirage. And the third of these, St. Trebio Water Litany. For tongues gone gray as greed, pray for us. For mothers dropping the last wet diamonds onto lips of ash, pray for us. For throats where even the blood has dried, pray for us. For amber eyes that see a shimmering, which is a whole country laughing, pray for us. For the ache that is an underground river, pray for us. For the oasis dream that comes too easily to the scared, pray for us who have no country, no air, only a river, a fence, and you. These St. Trebio poems.
Do you sit and think through every word of every stanza, or do you write freely and allow the words to flow?
I think I do the latter, at least first, kind of write freely, let ideas come out. And then I don't know that I revise as much as some poets, but then I go back and really cut down. My process is poems begin longer generally, and then they end shorter. So I go back and, I mean, I do at some point certainly sit and think through every word. But it's not usually how it starts. I usually start by, like you said, kind of writing freely and allowing the words to flow.
Well, when you think about poetry, yeah, crafting a poem, what are some of the most prevalent ingredients that go into the creation of a poem? What ingredients?
Well, certainly things like the first line and the last line.
All right.
I think.
All right.
obvious enough, but you and I both know that those are not simple things. That those require a lot of work. You know, what is the arc of the poem? Does it, you know, not just the craft of the first line and the last line, but how does it move from the first line to the last line? Does the poem get bigger? Does it go up in a certain way? Does the poem seem to get smaller? Sometimes for me, a poem might begin with just a couple of word phrase or a line or even part of a line, and maybe I build out from that. But I think some of the parts are certainly the opening and the closing, and then thinking about, is there a peak in the poem someplace? I think sometimes my poems, kind of build from the first line and maybe up to two thirds of the way through the poem, there might be a kind of a climax of sorts. And then there's a kind of a slowing down to the end. Sometimes you want to just go right to the end and let the end be a cliff and let the reader sort of go over the edge. But I think those are some parts, I guess. I think the sounds matter a lot too when I write, when I'm just composing, but certainly when I'm editing, I'm always reading it out loud, over and over and over, different parts of it. That's a help to me, I think, to hear it.
Where do you write?
A while ago, I think I would have said, always at my desk, and on paper, but that has changed a little bit. Although I'd say in the last several years, I do almost all of my writing now on a laptop, composing. So from the very beginning, and then editing. Occasionally I'll begin something on paper. That probably just means that I'm not at home or I'm not where my laptop is. I'm a high school teacher, and I do a lot of writing with my students. And I don't really use a laptop in the my classroom. So I often write, you know, if we're starting, if the students are writing poems or starting something, I often do that with them on paper. And occasionally that for me turns into a poem that I would actually keep. Other times, mm-hmm. like for them, I think it's just an exercise or something. But for the most part these days, I compose from beginning to end, pretty much finish on my computer. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a brief break and we'll be right back.
Okay.
Michael Anthony Ingram again. Welcome to Quintessential Listening Poetry. I'm here with Joseph Ross. The call-in number is 646-787-1631 if you'd like to ask a question of Joseph. Joseph, please share another of your works.
Sure. At the beginning of Ache, there is a series of poems on John Coltrane songs. In the last 10 years or so of my life, I've come late to jazz, but I've come. And
all right.
John Coltrane's works have mean a lot to me. So let me share a couple of these. I don't know the exact year he wrote this song, but when the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama was bombed on September 15th, 1963, where the four girls were killed. After that, John Coltrane wrote a song called Alabama to honor those girls. So this is on John Coltrane's Alabama, remembering Addie Mae Collins, Denise McNair, Carol Robertson, and Cynthia Wesley. There are no words for brick dust or fallen beams, only a piano rumbling, a ceiling collapsing. There is no sky in September when a stand-up bass has to preach forgiveness, when an angry man drives away from a church smiling. Cymbals wince in shock, stunned at the space between drum beats, pauses in a preacher's cadence that convert no one. Drums only sing in one language, but the maker of this Confederate memory does not recognize this tone. Pressing breath into a saxophone cannot resuscitate polished Sunday shoes, a blue satin dress, a dead girl's hand pointing to a window. It's on Alabama by John Coltrane. And some have said that in that poem, or in his song, John Coltrane is even trying to match some of the rhythms that Dr. King used in his funeral sermon for those girls, which is almost a creativity hard to imagine.
Yes, it is.
But in the last year of his life, Coltrane, after Dr. King died, John Coltrane wrote a song called Reverend King. So let me share that poem with you. So this is on John Coltrane's Reverend King. The tenor sax sings the concrete of Auburn Avenue, grandparents' front porch. It whispers Morehouse and tries to read music it hasn't learned yet. It gathers into a man's voice to chant Boston. Here the sax weaves a love song, falling over itself for a rhythm that could carry it, outlive it. It deepens and moves south to a Montgomery of empty buses, kitchen prayers, bombs threatened and real. Then drums rise to an angry Birmingham. The verses hum jailed. Their tones are letters, grace notes. Staccato police batons slice the air like the conductors of an insane choir. Coltrane's breath rushes through the saxophone now. The tune terrors in Vietnam. It prays scared in Selma. Its notes are water hoses, dog teeth, indifference. It sings symphony in Washington, chaos in Chicago. 1963 was cruel to this melody, this unfinished lunch counter where four little girls sit side by side and eat nothing. So finally, he puts down the sax as it fills with tears, unplayable. He takes up the bass clarinet because it sounds more like fury, like staring down a president. This song knows harmony. It is a choir called Watts. It sings riot in a new tongue, the language of the unheard. This song swirls now. It fills the world house with a straight-spined melody. This tune sings garbage men who are men. This rhythm has walked to a mountaintop. It tastes like a promise, so it clears its throat and soars, singing Memphis. John Coltrane's Dr. King.
You know, you write about race, immigration, and other social issues, social concerns. What kind of work are you drawn to reading yourself? And do you find yourself reading work similar to your own or completely different?
In poetry, I find myself reading some similar work, mostly similar work.
Okay.
I mean, I read a ton of poetry, so I don't only read sort of political or social justice themes. I really read a lot of fiction, and I'm drawn to some of the same themes in fiction. I love reading stories about places and people who are very different than from me. I think that's I have a real hunger for that. This past summer, just as an example, I did sort of a project of reading newish African fiction. So, you know, this whole new wave of African writers who aren't writing about colonialism, you know, they're beyond that. They're much more current. And I just found myself fascinated by some of their stories. And so I think, to me, yeah, I like when my reading can take me someplace that is very different from me, or at least from my experience. And I certainly draw, you know, can appreciate social justice themes still, but I love reading about people whose lives are different from mine.
Right.
That's a satisfaction for me, yeah.
All right. You know, speaking of writings from around the world, poets hail from all over the world. Where do you hail from?
I hail from right outside Los Angeles, California. I was born in a town called Pomona. It's about 25 miles east of downtown LA. And I lived there for 20 some years of my life. Went to college there in LA and then taught high school out there for a couple of years. Then I went into the seminary at Notre Dame, and I was there teaching for some years after I did graduate school there, and then moved 19 years ago now. I can't believe that. I moved to Washington, D.C. So I really think of D.C. as kind of my adopted hometown.
All right. Why is that?
Because it really is. It is home now for me. Like, I've been moving east all my life, and I've finally stopped. And I love D.C. It's a city with a lot of challenges these days, I think, around gentrification and inequality. But it's a great city for neighborhoods and culture and poetry and music. It's just a really great, and it's a relatively small city, but it's, you know, big being the national capital. You can walk around D.C. and see people you know. You know, I don't think that, I'm not sure that happens. My friends who live in New York don't ever talk about that. Yeah. So I've come to really love DC, and it's for sure my home.
All right. Please share another piece of your work.
Share a newer poem. Step outside of Ache for a minute, if that's okay.
Yes.
And this poem kind of touches on some of the a feeling I often have about my own education. So this poem is titled, "In All My Education, No Teacher or Professor Ever Spoke the Name Harriet Tubman." Maybe they feared the sounds would crackle in the complacent air, would charge the oxygen in the classroom, singeing the edges of history books. Or maybe her lawlessness angered them, the anarchy of her hands. Perhaps her inability to read upset their measures of strength and competence. Or it might be that her feminine determination, her constant return, her risks, her breath, always under her own control, was more than they thought we students should imagine. I mean, how could it be that this woman of seizures, this revolutionary in rags, could see so clearly into the bones of America? Thinking about Harriet Tubman.
You've mentioned your book, Ache, several times, and you've shared poems from Ache. Tell me about your book. Tell me about your book.
Yeah, sometimes how poets, you're writing, and all of a sudden you realize I have a lot of poems. And what I do is I use a big queen bed. I spread out the poems all over the bed. I know some poets who tape poems to walls, you know, and use their whole, like, a big double closet door wall or something.
Wow.
So spread them all out on the bed and begin to look at, are there groupings here? Could there be a collection here? And if there was a collection here, are there sections? And as I looked at all these poems, I realized that they were quite different in some ways. But a similar thing that they all had was a kind of ache, a kind of yearning for love, for justice, for peace, for safety. And the word ache came to me a little bit after realizing that they were all about a hunger or a yearning. And I really, once I found the word ache, I just really loved it because it can be negative. You know, you can have a headache, you can have a backache.
Yes.
But we also ache, like we ache for people that we love. We ache for a future that's different. And that's a good thing. Those are good things. So I felt like that word, the word ache, has a couple of layers. It's not entirely negative. And it kind of came together. That's kind of how it came together, by putting, you know, kind of laying a bunch of, you know, the poems over the course of a couple of years, laying them all out, and all of a sudden seeing a thread that when I just looked at them individually, or, you know, how you might look at them on a computer screen, I don't know that I would have seen that thread, but when I spread them all out, it became clear pretty fast. Yeah.
Well, if you had to convince a friend or a colleague to read your book, what might you tell them?
Huh. That is a tough one. You know, I don't know that I'm the best salesman of my own product, but
all right.
I'll give it a shot.
All right. Yeah, please do so.
I mean, I think, you know, that ache, that hunger that we have for those things that I just mentioned, for love, for safety, for a different kind of future, those are really human things. Those are things we all have in common. And if one is willing to step into that journey a little bit, into writing that might help one to feel some of those things, I'd say try that. If you think you want to feel, are willing to feel some of these things, I'd like to think that ache isn't just a book where you'll know what I think, But I hope that it's something that can kind of pluck the string inside of other people to feel some of these same aches, both the sad ones and the more positive ones. So I guess talking my way around it, but to try to say it as bluntly as I can. So, you know, you, my friend or my reader, or my potential reader, you might find your own hungers in some of these poems. I'd love for you to give it a try.
Oh, wow. You know, is your book available on Amazon?
It is. It is. And it's also available from the publisher, Sibling Rivalry Press. You can go there and go to their bookstore, and it's there. But it is also on Amazon as well, yeah, which I know is easy for a lot of people.
Well, I plan to buy a copy.
I'm grateful.
And, yes, I plan to buy a copy. And to my listening audience, it sounds like a great book for the wintertime. So look out for it. Look out for it.
Yeah.
All right. Please share another piece of your work.
Let me go back into ache then. There are I'm flipping around here. At the beginning of ache, there is a section of poems in the voice of Nelson Mandela. And so I'd like to share a couple of those. In the poetry world, people call these persona poems, where you take on someone else's voice. And I know some people get anxious about that. It can be a little bit of a tricky thing to do. I think you have to be careful taking on someone else's voice, obviously, especially someone like Mandela, who so many people admire. But I hope I honor both him and the person that he is speaking to in these poems. So let me share three of these short ones. This is Nelson Mandela speaks to Mamie Till. On some August nights, I think every mother is a martyr. I know you would resist that thought. It was your son, you would say, not you. And you would be right, and you would be wrong. Mothers loved sons in 1955, especially when the sons slept hundreds of miles away. I was banned that year. It was the beginning of living in rocks, behind rocks. By the end, I knew about walls. You knew walls too. The wooden walls of barns where screams could not be seen. Transparent walls of coffins, letting a country see what it had to save. Nelson Mandela speaks to Tupac Shakur. Some say we have nothing in common, but we were both born into revolution and lived. We sang the same century, though it rarely sang to us. We read the bad news of ghettos and tried to write a gospel they could believe. You loved your mother like a country. I loved my country like the mother she was not. In a city of light, you were killed too soon. In a country at dawn, I keep being born. And the last of these three Mandela poems is Nelson Mandela speaks to Trayvon Martin. I walk down Fox Street in Johannesburg at dawn. A light rain darkens my shoes. They scrape against the small stones. I'm standing in the doorway when I see you across the street, on the corner, looking at me. You wear no hood today. You smile and walk toward me. I smile and wait for you. The day begins here. Coffee and tea stands push back their canvas covers. A whistle sings from the train station. Your arms swing at your sides like only a teenage boy's arms can swing. You look like you might open your mouth to sing. There is no SUV in sight. I'm not sure how to greet you. So I look at your wet, grass-stained shoes and back at your 17-year-old face. I say, come in. Get out of the rain. Nelson Mandela speaking to Trayvon Martin.
Your poetry packs a punch. And I'm sure your poems would have made Nelson Mandela proud.
Well, that might be the best compliment those poems can get. I'm very grateful for that. Thank you.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Well, let's take a brief break, and we'll be right back. Questions for Joseph. The call-in number is 646-787-1631. Joseph.
Yes, sir.
All right. All poets have several words that come up over and over again. Words or sentences that they just can't help but use in their work. What are three of your absolute favorite words to use?
That is good. I think, in some ways, I think I use them too much, but it's because of exactly what you just said. But I find I use the word baptism. That's a really layered, beautiful image, I think. I think I use the word language a lot. I write about people talking in a different kind of language. I've used that phrase maybe more than I should. And I use the word country. Sometimes writing about a very small or a one-on-one kind of incident and relating it to the larger country. And I know I've found myself using that word a lot. So I don't know what that means. What did I say? Baptism, language,
baptism?
And country.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Those are pretty deep words.
And those words find their way in my work. Yeah.
Well, you know, they make the statement that to see the world with complete honesty, one should look to comedians, artists, and poets. What do you think emerges naturally from your work?
I hope that my work urges people to slow down, to look more deeply at a person I'm writing about or some human situation between people. I hope my work would urge somebody to slow down, to take a kind of a deeper look at something. Sometimes I write historical poems, and so sometimes it's a matter of, you know, asking people to remember something. I write a lot of elegies. I'm a big believer in that elegies can have a kind of a resurrection power almost. So that's a kind of inviting the reader to slow down and to look at someone else's life and to see what that might mean for us today, something like that.
All right. All right. Please share another piece of your work.
Sure. I'd like to share a newer poem. If I can plug this, there's a brand new anthology that's just out called What Saves Us? Poems of Empathy and Outrage in the Age of Trump. And it is, it's been edited by Martina Spada, who is a poet I really admire and whose work I love. And so it's a whole collection of, they're pretty political poems, but they are sort of poems about empathy and poems about outrage. So as I was saying earlier to you, the reality of transgender people came up some years ago with somebody I was speaking with, and I just realized it was something I didn't know anything about. And what I've learned, one of the things I've learned since is, you know, America is undergoing a kind of it's this long string of murders, especially of trans women of color, both in Washington, D.C. and across the country. These women are being killed at rates that are just beyond comprehension. And so when I began to dig into to this world a little bit, in 2015, a young woman named Zella Ziana, a transgender woman, was murdered in Gaithersburg, Maryland, not too far here from D.C., just a little bit north of Washington, D.C. And her story moved me. I read an article about her murder in the Washington Post, and then about the trial of a man who was arrested and tried and found guilty of her murder. So this poem, again, an elegy, maybe inviting people to look into a part of life many of us don't know much about. So this is called For Zella Ziana. Because the reasons he shot you in an alley are not reasons. Because he thinks you embarrassed him in front of men. Because these men speak a language unknown in your shifting world. Because also known as is a funeral in America. Because gunshot wounds to the head and groin speak clearly a language some men know. Because when a black girl is called a black boy by a maternity nurse, the language dissolves again, the name crumbles, and a soul must wait to emerge. Because she might be born again, not of Jesus, but of herself. Because you took your own name, baptized in your own language, named for a saint only you pray to. Because your saint does not stop bullets just because you are beautiful. That's for Zella Zian, a transgender woman killed here near D.C. in 2015. And it's from this anthology called What Saves Us, edited by Martina Spada, which I'm really grateful is out in the world. Northwestern University Press got it into the world, and I'm really glad of that.
Fantastic. What do you see as being the role of a poet in modern-day society?
Yeah, that's a very important question, and it's a really important thing, I think, especially these days, for poets to take seriously. The role of a poet today, I think, is to create beauty, a beauty that is rooted in truth. Langston Hughes is remembered to have said in an essay that he wrote on being a social poet, he wrote, "Poets who write mostly about love, roses and moonlight, sunsets and snow, must lead a very quiet life." And so I don't write a lot of poems about sunset and snow, and it's not because I have some loud or big life. But the world is hurting, and I think it's important for poets to not be afraid to write into that, to write about it, to write from it, to write to it sometimes. Poetry is such an important form, and it affects people in such powerful and deeply human ways. Its rhythm is like our heartbeat. Its sounds are like our own efforts at language. It's really important, I think, that we use this form to speak to the injustices that are part of the world around us, to give people voices whose voices aren't commonly heard, or like I said before, in the elegy form, to maybe bring somebody back from the dead who still has something to teach us. I think there is a public role for poetry in the world, and that we shouldn't sit back, especially these days, you know, where politically people lie in public constantly. People act as though words don't have definitions. It's very important for poets to get out into the world and to confront these ideas. I think it's a very important time. And so I, you know, at readings, especially where if I'm doing a reading or I go to a reading where there are lots of other poets, I really urge people, we got to be everywhere, you know, like on blog, mm-hmm. on the radio, and we need to be reading in ninth grade classrooms and elder homes and prisons and jails and every place. We got to be out there. The world needs poetry. It needs the truth and the beauty that our work can provide. I just really believe very deeply in that public role for poetry.
Wow. An excellent answer. Wow. Excellent answer. Question.
Thank you.
Do you think, based on everything that you know about poetry in your life and your world, your lived experience, that you were meant to be a poet?
I do, actually. Yeah.
Okay. Tell me more.
Yeah, I do. Well, I think people have been gracious to me. When I was in graduate school and in a seminary, a friend of mine named Jane Pitts told me that I had a poet's heart. And at the time, I didn't really know what that meant. But I think she was right. And I don't mean this in self-praise, but I mean, I think she saw that I was a reflective person. I was someone who could see things and then tried to use language to craft what, you know, then it was mostly in essays and that kind of thing. But I do think that I think all my life I've been sort of building to this. As a kid, I was a crazy, wild reader. My parents always had, you know, a stack of library books on each side of their bed, and it was a weekly or more often a trip from our house to the public library. In the summers, especially, you know, my sister and I always did the reading contests that the public library would have, you know, how many books you can read over the summer, that kind of thing. I just think I've always been in love with language and with what it can do. So yeah, I think it's my vocation. I mean, I think,
Does knowing that your poems are published and out there in the world validate your being a poet, or are you content knowing that they're out of your system?
That's a good way to put it, out of your system. Right. Once you get it out and you put the last period in, at least it's out of your system. I have felt that satisfaction sometimes and thought, who cares what else happens to this poem? It's just out of my system. I'm not going to lie. I think that I'm happy to know that people read my work. I'm happy to know that that some of it does get out into the world published, whether it's individually or in books. There's a great satisfaction in that. I feel like I've been very lucky in that part of the poetry world too. You know, I think there are a lot of good poets who have not gotten books published, who have not had the fortune I've had. I don't know. And there are poets who have been far more fortunate than I, but I mean, I think there's a kind of satisfaction in knowing that your work is more than just on your desk. Although that is a perfectly legitimate way to be a poet. I tell my students all the time that, you know, being a public poet is one thing, but to write a poem just that you love, or to write poetry that you love, and maybe you never share it with anyone. That's a perfectly legitimate way to be a poet. Maybe you write poems and just share them with your friends or your loved ones. So that's a little bit of a public poet, but not like publishing public. That's okay too. That's a perfectly legit way to be a poet. And then there are those of us who, you know, put ourselves through the torment of sending poems out and, you know, dealing with rejection letters and all of that. But there, you know, it's a, I guess I've chosen that part of it, and I'm happy to choose that part of it. And I'm always glad when a poem can help someone else if it can. But to know that they're out there is a deep satisfaction to me. I'm really grateful for that. Yeah.
Well, share another piece of your work.
Okay. How about an historical poem? I, as I told you, I'm a high school teacher. I teach American literature and poetry. And I've come to discover in the last several years of teaching American literature, this hero that I never knew much about, and that is Frederick Douglass. I've really come to see his life as the quintessential American life. I would go so far as to say, I think he is the American founder. I think Washington and Jefferson did not get it. They were there at the moment of the founding. They wrote some of the documents. But if you're a slave owner, you don't understand what America is about. And Douglass, while he wasn't there at the founding, he absolutely understood what America was about. So I've really come to this great admiration for him, and have a lengthy poem. I just want to read a couple of parts of it, called The North Star, in praise of Frederick Douglass. One, a boy is born beside a bay that will one day free him, but not today. He flushes wet and bound from a mother he will not know. He remembered later that he never saw her in the light of day. He saw her only in the darkness, after a day kneeling in the fields and in the pre-dawn blackness before her skin could begin to sweat. The first lesson his country taught him, memory is a wound. Part two. His owner, Thomas Auld, would send him to Baltimore to a cousin whose home needed the service only an owned child can give, a dependence raw and sure. The wife there taught him that shapes made letters, made sounds, made words, made possible and not possible. He carefully hid the spelling books white children left for trash. Their letters, their curves and straight lines were sails. They could float across water that did not devour them. He drank from them in the dark to conspire against the darkness itself. And let me read part four of this. The first owner summoned him back.
You can read as much as you like.
Thank you. Part four. The first owner summoned him back. But now he was 16 years old. He was a lamp, a burning. This boy was a reading thirst. He could not be contained. He was beyond them now. But they had a weapon still, a man who breaks slaves. William Covey, a poor man whose name is terror, whose reputation is as one who severs others from themselves. This reading boy will learn from him. Part five. His skin learns many lessons. How long one can bleed before losing sight. How breathing in, just as the whip strikes, can soften its cut. How a kind of silence confronts the breaker who whips you with a rebellious question, who is the animal here? He eats little. He thins out from the inside until his ribs have names. His wrist bones tell him stories, but he learns to translate the hissing whip and the hands that whirl it. He learns there is a language here. Its name is unspoken, but its books are not hard to read or understand. And one day, during a beating that fractures almost everything. He looks into the slave breaker's eyes. He raises his hand to block the fist beating him. He takes hold of that man's throat, and even the air gasps. Everything breaks but him. So a little part of this much longer poem honoring Frederick Douglass, who, as I said, is just this hero that I have recently come to really appreciate.
The quintessential man.
He was, yeah.
All right. How has your idea of what poetry is and what poetry can do changed since you began writing poetry?
That's a very good question. Well, for one thing, the idea, like in that last poem, the idea of a lengthy, multi-part poem, that's a very recent thing for me. I began, I think my poems were very short for many years. I almost wanted to be able to see the whole poem the whole time on the page. So it had there's a certain length that you can't go past. But I've really changed that. I guess I'm not so afraid now of writing longer poems. Another thing that I discovered a few years ago that's really been a help to me that I didn't do for a long time, I had never done before, was drafting poems. So when I first composed, putting them down, drafting poems in two-line stanzas, in couplets, that somehow enables me to see more options for line breaks and just different ways of moving things around. And when I was writing in just, you know, longer 8 or 10 or 12 line stanzas, I couldn't see the poem as well. But breaking it into two line stanzas enabled me to see all kinds of other possibilities. And now mostly they stay in those two line stanzas. Ache is almost an entire book, not completely, but almost an entire book of poems in two-line stanzas. So those are a couple of changes that have happened, I would say, in the last 8 or 9 years that I think have helped my poems. I hope they've helped my poems. It feels like they have. And I think taking more risks, like I said, you know, writing poems in the voices of other people, there are a lot of poets who would really shy away from that, or who would even say others shouldn't do it. And I guess I have felt a little more freedom than that, and I don't let those potential criticisms stop me very much.
You know, some poets are also active in other creative areas. What are some of your favorite non-poetry or literature activities?
Well, I love visual art. I love photographs. I guess I have a phone like most Americans. So, and my phone is the best camera I've ever had. So I do take a lot of pictures, but I don't know that I think of them as artistic sometimes, maybe. But I love, you know, living in Washington, D.C., there are tons of galleries and museums, and I'm a big fan of the art of Jean-Michel Basquiat. I'm a big fan of various painters, and I'm a big fan of graffiti art. DC is actually a really good city for graffiti art. And I've even done some writing about some of that. So some of those have been helpful things for me. Other ways of appreciating art apart from the written word, or apart from literary stuff.
Wow. You know, we've come to the end of the hour, which is...
How'd that happen?
I don't know. Wow, this was really nice. I would like to ask you last question.
Sure.
When people hear your work, I'm sure they usually want more. What's next for you as a poet?
I have a book that's coming out in the fall of 2020. And so, you know how it works with books, in a way, like it's done. So I'm not really sure it's next, but it is the next thing that I'll be working with publicly, at least. And it's a book of poems all about Dr. King. It's called Raising King, and it uses quotes from three of his books to do a kind of a poetic biography of Dr. King, who is maybe my greatest hero. So that's a coming out about a year from now, and that'll, you know, be a lot of activity for me. But what is the next real thing when it comes to writing? I don't know yet. And that, it's a little bit of a weird feeling. I mean, I'm writing stuff, you know, but I guess I don't have enough yet to throw it all onto the queen size bed to see if it looks like it might be a book. I don't know. So I don't have big writing deserts, which I'm always really grateful for. I'm usually writing. So I guess we'll see. I don't really know what's next in terms of the what is new to be created. But I'm really excited about this King book. I just think the world is better the more people know and understand Dr. King's work. So I am excited about that. Yeah.
Great. Well, I want to thank you, Joseph, for spending some time with me. And
well,
I wish
you
nothing
Michael,
but the best.
Thank you.
I'd like you to return to talk about King's book, your King's book.
I'd love that. I'd love
and
that.
I'd like you to
thank
return,
you.
And we can schedule that. So to my listening
thank
audience,
you.
Good night, and thank you so much. Thank you.